Hey, folks, welcome back to the DC3Cast. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Vince. Zach is still dead, but his resurrection is pending. So we're here to talk about two comics that came out on the 19th of March in 2024, starting with Justice Society of America number 9, written by Jeff Johns, illustrated by Michael Janin. And Vince, we've kind of popped in and out of this book over the last year and a half that has been published, even though it's only 9 issues in.
Jesus.
I looked it up the other day. It was October or November of 22 that it started. And what? Here we sit in March of 24, and we're still only 9 issues in.
No way.
Yeah, ton of delays on this. And we all know this is the most Brian Nippy of Brian Nip books. And so yeah. I want to start with you because this is not as Vince Nippy as it is.
Right.
And just kind of talk about what your general feeling of this issue is, and specifically sort of what this issue is trying to do, which is it's really, in some ways, this last arc of the book is hearkening back to the first issue, which was all about Huntress putting together this new JSA that was the children of supervillains. And then things kind of went sideways a bit and changed a little bit throughout the rest of the book until it got to issue 7 or 8, and that's sort of another refocus. So how do you feel that that's working, and what do you think of this issue?
Sideways, speaking of a youngster that's gone missing and I wish I were in Japan and Zach were here right now because he would want to talk about this. This book is okay, but it really reeks of late era Johns in that it's trying to do way too much. And in doing so, almost every sort of like plot point or point that it's trying to make, it's making in the most like obvious or rote way because it's got to get it out there, you know, for a book that has, you know, it's only 9 issues, but yet, like you said, a year and a half, for a book that's been going on this long, it's not, it's fighting against being a slow burn, but I don't think it really succeeds at that. And what I mean by that is like, we've been dealing with the offspring of the, you know, villains from the past or whatever, the forgotten villains of the past or whatever. You've got the Ruby Sokov, which is the kid of the what did they call that?
Golden Age Red Lantern.
The Golden Age Red Lantern. Yeah, there's the Harlequin son, and all of this is like it's. You're watching the same scene over and over again, right? They're like attempting to recruit the offspring of some forgotten villain from the past or whatever. And the point that is trying to be made later in the book about all of this is that why do you heroes care so much about going around and rounding us up? You only care about people in costume. You've lost sight of the people on the street or the regular people, you know? And I don't think Johns is clearly trying to craft some narrative about how superhero comics are maybe like insular and too wrapped up in continuity. But then again, that's the only thing he really likes to do. And it's not really squaring that circle very well for me. Like, I feel like it's trying to dance around saying something, and it's not really saying anything.
Am I making any sense? No,
you know what I mean?
I understand that. I do. I guess to me, that's secondary.
Okay.
For two reasons. Number one, I think that there is enough going on here, even if you take that stuff out of it, I just love world building. You know, one of the reasons I love JSA so much is that JSA has all these incredible characters that are you know, each one has a like a world unto itself. When you bring them together in the JSA, you're bringing in like all these corners of the DC universe, and you can explore those corners and all that. So on that hand, like, I fucking love this. I think this is the best because you're just getting all these characters. I mean, this issue has a section about the JSA reserves and fucking damage gets mentioned. So, you know, I threw my fist in the air when that happened. And
he's mentioned though. You don't even see him.
Yes, you do. Like... Yes, you do. He is in one of those bubbles. You absolutely see him.
Okay. All right.
But, you know, like I eat that shit up. But that is tempered by the fact that we know we're never going to see these characters again. Johns is maybe not even going to finish this book. And then who knows what happens with this team again, right? Like, I just feel like all of that is baked into this. Like, this book is so delayed that even if there was a follow-up plan for it, that follow-up is now out of the continuity that it needs to be because it was supposed to wrap up, you know, 6 months ago. And so... Mm-hmm. You're in this trap of like you're watching this incredible meal be prepared, knowing you're never gonna be able to eat it, and that is a very frustrating thing as a reader to deal with. But it's not so much the trying to make the point about the only caring for superheroes or only caring for costumes or capes, however they say it. Like I guess I understand that, and maybe that is supposed to be leading things in a different direction in the last few issues, and I could see that maybe. But to me, this is a book that is absolutely marred by its delays and its circumstances. You know, Johns is wrapping up his time at DC. You know that if this started like 6 weeks later, you'd see a Ghost Machine book called like the Good Guys Association of the States, and it would just be a shittier version of this. So all of that to me, that's what weighs it down to me, is just the knowledge that none of this is going to go anywhere, that this is a dry hump of a book, and that bums me out because, like I said, all of the elements here story wise are sort of working for me. Aside from that, just caring about heroes thing, and even that, I don't think is terrible. I think interesting stuff could come of that. I'm just doing the thing that we all do when you're at a movie that you know is 2.5 hours long, and it's 2 hours and 15 minutes in, and you don't know how they're going to wrap up all the story in the next 15 minutes. That's mm-hmm. how this book feels to me. It's just all of this is going to be built up to something that's going to then just go no place. And I recognize that's a me problem in a lot of ways, that we should not be taking in comics in a way that just makes it, that's just looking for the next thing. But when you're a superhero comics reader, that isn't that kind of all you do? Like, so much of what we do is looking forward.
And again, that's all Geoff Johns does, right? And so, and we like right. that, you
right.
know,
yes.
generally. And so, no, yeah, you're forgiven for doing that, and certainly that was a more exciting prospect when you knew that this guy could be on a book for as long as he wanted to be, basically, right?
Right.
Like in John's heyday, he could probably tell DC, "I'm doing 100 issues of this," and they'd say, "Yes, sir."
You know? Right. Right. Yeah.
It's just not that world anymore.
Right. I know you're not a huge Michael Janin fan at this point in your life.
No.
What do you think of what he's doing here?
I really didn't like it. A lot of weird angles, a lot of like weird close-ups on faces. There's a panel where like somebody's falling off of a building or so. I think it might be the Harlequin Sun. I don't have the comic in front of me right now, but like I just think that looks bad. The way that he does like these very like posed or modeled compositions with his characters, anytime you have them doing something out of the ordinary other than just kind of like standing around or sitting around or maybe even some light fighting, you know, anytime you get more complicated or oddball with the with your angle or your perspective, I don't think it comes off very well. And there was a weird amount of that in this comic.
I could see that.
Yeah, I'd like to think of some more specific examples of it, but let me pull the comic up while you talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that Janine is somebody who, when he first came up, I think the first thing I was really aware of him doing was Grayson. And I liked him for that book. I thought he did the super spy stuff pretty well. I think he works less well with superhero, like, magic and flying and shit. But I don't think he's a bad artist necessarily. I just think that it's a style that I don't think particularly fits this team. Like, what I love about this particular JSA team is how many different types of heroes there are on it. Like, you have magic stuff, and you have Green Lantern stuff, and you have speedster stuff, and you have science stuff, and all of those things all sort of get flattened out by Janine's work, where his work is sort of its own thing to the degree of, instead of, like, you know, we have talked a bit on this show about the Mike Deodato art in The Flash and how at least a couple of us, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but at times we have all said we're not big Deodato fans, but what Deodato is doing on The Flash is different than what he's normally doing, and it really works. I think with Janine, instead of adapting his style to the book, he adapts the book to his style. So I don't think anything pops the way it should, because it's sort of all been flattened into the Janine, you know, aesthetic. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. Okay. Yeah, I pulled up the comic. I have some specific examples of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
There, it's the scene where the Harlequin son throws that goon off of the...
Yes, I knew that was the scene you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that looks pretty bad. I think even later when the Harlequin son himself jumps off of the roof, it doesn't look great. And it's because, like, again, outside of, like, sort of the posing, when he's asked to do dynamic action like that, I just don't think it comes off very well. There's another, this is minor, but when Icicle's looking into there's a closed circuit television in his cell that he's in, and he's like looking into it. It's trying to go for a fisheye lens thing, but it's not at all. Yeah, it's not quite doing it, you know. But I don't want to entirely shit on him, because I also want to contrast what I'm saying about, like, when he's asked to do something outside of his comfort zone, I don't think it comes off well. When he's in his comfort zone, I think it looks pretty good. And so, examples of that, the double page spread with the title page where Mr. Terrific's standing and looking at his T-spheres flying around and showing him,
yeah,
like,
we'll call that the damage page. Yeah.
The damage page. Yeah. Is damage in there? I didn't.
Damage is in the, if you're looking at Mr. Terrific, the bubble over his right shoulder, Damage is throwing a punch.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go. All right. I didn't look carefully enough, I guess. And then on the kind of the other side of the double page, you've got Jay and Judy running. I think that looks pretty good. I think at the end, when, spoiler alert, Legionnaire reveals himself to be Mordru, stupid, sexy Mordru, that stuff all looks pretty good, but it's heroes sitting around a table.
Right. How hard is it to do that? Yeah.
How hard is it to do? Yeah. And, you know, all I'm saying is it looks good. Like, I think his characters look pretty good when they're in static situations. Right. So I think that whole scene is handled pretty well. Is there a degree of difficulty there? Not really, but it's an example of, like, I don't think his art is shit or anything like that. I just think it's suited to a certain thing, and the action is not very dynamic, unfortunately.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think all of that is well said. And I think that one of the things that has to come from reading as many comics as we do is I'm glad that we haven't lost our objectivity and that you can still say this stuff works and this doesn't, as opposed to just the knee-jerk reaction of I'm tired of this guy or this guy's not a good fit for this book, right? It's one of the frustrating things. So for those that don't know, I write a weekly, I'm part of the weekly column on 2000 AD for Multiversity. And I'm currently reviewing a book that I hate the art for. And like every single week, I have to find new ways to shit on the art or to try to find good things to say about it. And it's really hard sometimes to not just fall into the same pattern that you fall into. So I think it's good that you are able to find enough objectivity to point out both things. And I think you're being fair with your critiques of him. So yeah, good work with that.
Thank you.
Do you have any idea, or do you have any gut? Idea is the wrong word. Do you have any gut feeling about what we're going to do with these characters after this book's over?
No. And it's because, again, Johns is doing the thing that I kind of was alluding to earlier, where he just keeps stacking this stuff up in a way that, like, I think he's orbiting around a point, but I don't think he's making it. And I don't think he's going to have time to make it with what we know about.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, how much more can he do? First of all, it doesn't seem like he's done. Like, it seems like we're going to get a Jack. Are we going to see Jack Knight in this, by the way?
If there's anywhere we're going to see Jack Knight, it's in this.
Well, so, did you read issue 8?
Yeah, I did. You're going to have to refresh my memory.
So in issue 8, this is when Helena Wayne is talking about all the different people she wants to go meet with. And one of the ones she mentions is Kyle Knight. And they say, like, Kyle Knight's 5 years old. And you see Kyle and Jack looking through a telescope.
Oh, yeah.
So I wonder if we're going to, like, if we're going to see... I mean, we haven't seen Jack Knight in a comic. Jack Knight hasn't spoken a word in a comic in over 20 years. So, or close to 20 years. Maybe it's not quite 20, but it's close to 20 years. So, like, you know, it's a big deal if that actually happens. And, you know, that's the most Brian Nip thing of all. But it's a, you know, I don't, but the reason I bring that up is I don't get the impression that Johns is done building things out before coming to an end game here. I think we're going to get at least one more issue of things like expanding before the contraction begins. I mean, even just the way this issue ends with the, you know, stupid sexy Mordru, as you said, and the Legionnaire, like even that that's a big swing to be making in issue 9 of a 12-issue miniseries, right? There's just so much here. And again, I like that. I like it when a book feels overstuffed and it feels like this is spiraling out of control. That's cool. What's not cool is knowing that there's no real light at the end of the tunnel here. In terms of anything, really, I guess. I don't know how this wraps up. And again, I just get the impression that no one is prepared to follow this, and so it just won't be followed up.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer for a lot of reasons. Anything else to say about it?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Okay. Well, then let's move on to our second book of the week, the April special, number one. April, get it? April.
I don't get it.
You don't get it? Okay, well, ask your parents about it. So this is a book that I thought was going to be a one-and-done thing, but we're already getting a follow-up story in Batman, the Brave and the Bold in a few months. So that's a thing. But this also brings two writers that have not been working at DC for a long time back into the fold, and that's John Layman and Joshua Hale-Fialkov. And I think you and I are both sort of skeptical when these type of books are released, because on one hand, they seem like they're just cash grabs, like a weird way to make some extra money in April. But I also think that we like seeing underutilized characters show up. Both of us like some humor in our comics. And so this was a, I had no idea what to expect going into this. I'm curious what you thought of it when you finished reading it.
I thought it was okay. I think you have a, I know you have a higher tolerance for the sort of like King Kong, Planet of the Apes, Godzilla, Silver Age silliness sort of thing getting inserted into comics.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I my patience wears thin with that stuff. Like when we read JL Apes or JL Ape or
JLA,
whatever, yeah, whatever it's called, I that was just too much. And
Well,
granted,
that's
that was
objectively
like,
bad.
it's
So.
bad and it's like six, seven, eight issues of bad, you know? This for one issue for like a one-off special, I can dig it. I thought my problem with it is that I don't think the story's any good. I think there's a lot of funny jokes within it. Some of the gags are good, but I don't think there's a story here. Although I did like the Fialkoff Phil Hester Detective Chimp short. We'll get to that,
Yeah, we'll get to
but
that.
like, yeah, the main one, the longer story, it just seemed like an excuse for a chain of gags, which again, for one issue, that's fine. I don't begrudge, you know, I'm just not in love with it, you know. Like for example, the monkey Nomicon is a funny
Yes.
that's a funny gag, right? Oh God. One that is not funny, but I can at least like, I don't know. I can roll my eyes and not begrudge the pun is the Legion of Doo Ooh Ah-Am.
Yes.
I mean,
I was hoping you
that's,
would say that and not me.
yeah, that is a groaner and a half, but like,
A
you
groan
gotta
or not a
hand it.
boner?
You gotta hand it to the terror group known as ISIL sometimes. That's a drill tweet. That's
Yes,
not
it
me
is.
talking.
It is a gentleman,
Oh,
yes.
but the best joke in this story, which maybe makes the whole thing worth it, was the sign that they like hung a sign up on, I think, Mansur Mala after they turned on him, and it said, "Traitor to apes, spank this monkey."
Yes, that is.
I did laugh out loud at that one. That was, yeah, I like that. But yeah, I mean, to me, it was just a bunch of jokes and a paper thin story, and that's by design. That's certainly not, it's not Layman dropping the ball at all. It's the assignment. He understands the assignment perfectly. It's
Yes.
just that the assignment's not necessarily something I go for.
And that's fair. And that's fair. So in terms of the main story here, it's fun and silly. And how can I say this in a way that is not going to be horribly, horribly offensive? No, I'm not even gonna say it. I'm not. This reminds me of another book that came out this year, in so that there's a lot. They just Layman seemingly crammed every monkey character, every ape character he could in here. And what I appreciated about it was that even though there is an explanation for why they're all together, the explanation is kind of just because this is the monkey book. Right? Like
Yeah.
there was not like too deep of a there is not, sometimes there tries to be this like overly complicated and deep reason of why there should be all the monkeys and apes together. But there's none of that here, and that's good. Just tell the story. Like you said, it's silly, get in and get out. I thought the Carl Mostert art was pretty good in the first story. It's not my favorite style of comic booking, but I thought that overall it looks pretty good, and there was a lot of he rolls with the gags pretty well, as you said, you know. I liked the team up of Sam Simeon and Bobo and Monkey Prince. So that was fun. I don't really know why the book had to be divided into all these chapters.
Yeah, that was
at first I thought at first I was like, chapter two, this isn't Phil Hester art. I thought he was doing the second part of this story, because the way that it's sort of laid out, it looks mm-hmm. like these are different creators. But I thought this is just all the John Layman story. So I don't know why that was really there. But like, you know, we have talked about the DC anthology books. And what's fun about them is you can pull out these weird little characters and corners of the universe. You don't really see that often. And if this turns out to be a once in a while anthology book team, I'm totally fine with that. That's fun enough for me. And I think we're taking this. I think you and I are talking about this exactly as seriously as it should be talked about. I don't think you should have to read any more into this. So that's a good thing.
And maybe perhaps we're taking it too seriously, but I can't.
Probably.
It's funny because I like to think I have a good sense of humor, but like I only have so much patience for puns. I don't know. It's a thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Let's talk about this next story. It's called Detour. It's a Detective Chimp story. It's written by Joshua Hale-Fialkoff, friend of the show, and illustrated by Phil Hester. I want to start off by saying this is the good Phil Hester.
Yes.
We have talked a lot about the good and the bad Phil Hester over the course of our various shows, and this is the good Phil Hester, certainly. I loved the way this looked.
Mm-hmm.
The coloring is really, really nice on this, too. Phil Hester just, man, when he's on, he might be one of my favorite artists out there. Like, everything about this, it's hard-boiled, but it never forgets that it's also a chimp story, so it's kind of silly in parts. I just want to look up who did the colors, so I really did enjoy the colors, specifically the use of red. D. Cuniff, excellent, excellent use of colors. And I thought that Fialkoff did a really good job of making Bobo everything that he is. He is supposedly, you know, one of the greatest detectives in the world. He's clever. He's a little silly. I think all of that is present here. It's a really, really good story.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And again, it gets in and it gets out, you know? And I don't want it to be any longer than it is. It's the perfect length. I almost wish that, they should do like half anthology, you know, because sometimes those anthology comics that have like 10 stories in them at 10 pages a piece can be a little long in the tooth. I feel like they could do like anthology books where there's 5 stories at 10 pages a piece. And then I think that first story would have cooked a little harder than it did.
Agreed.
The Detective Chimp one, it hits the tone and the notes that it's aiming for. So like Detective Chimp is hitching a ride with a murderer, and he knows that the guy murdered somebody, and the way that he plays it to get that out of the guy and talks, you know, it's a very talky story, right? But like, this is where a talky story can work really well, because the mood that Hester delivers through the art, which is more or less static, is is just perfect to get across this very tense, and yet like it's tense, but like you always feel like Detective Chimp is in control also, you know?
Yes.
It strikes this perfect balance of tension and like displaying this Bobo as hyper competent, you know?
Yeah.
And then it has like a somewhat poignant ending.
Yes.
Poignant's maybe strong, but like, you know, it's saying something about the nature of man, right?
Yes.
In a way. It's really good. It's really good.
Yeah. Let me be the first to say welcome back, Josh Vialkov. Glad to see you.
Yeah.
And then we get to the Monkey Prince story. And the best thing about this Monkey Prince story, and this is not a slam on anything else that happens in it, I'm just so glad that Gene Yang and Bernard Chang seemingly own this character in the eyes of DC. And that every time we get another Monkey Prince story, it is with these guys as the creative team behind it. Because DC so rarely fully gives these characters a creative team that owns them, you know? And I love that. Because the story itself is fine.
Yeah, it's well, it's a payoff on the first story, right?
Right.
And it so you know, Marcus's or Monkey King's arms can like detach, or he can detach his limbs. And one of them detaches and leads him basically to the lair where the secret lab where they're cloning Marcus's arm to make more Monkey King arms using the arms of these monkeys that they've cut their arms off. It's a little bit convoluted, but it's a good payoff from the earlier story. The weirdest part though is Monkey King's grandpa is Ultra Humanite. Monkey Prince thing. I'm thinking of the actual story. The
yes.
Monkey King. Monkey Prince. I wrote in my notes Monkey King too. Oh, Jesus. But anyway, Ultra Humanite is his grandpa, apparently.
Yeah.
Is that canon?
I don't know if I just haven't read all the Monkey Prince stuff and we knew that already, or that's the world's weirdest reveal to drop in the middle of this book.
Yeah, I certainly don't remember it.
Yeah, I had the same thought.
You know, that's DC's first supervillain, Ultra Humanite.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Yep, except he used to be drawn like basically just like a chunkier Lex Luthor.
Yes, yeah. And then for a while, the Ultra Humanite was a woman.
Oh, it's a lady.
Or rather, the brain of the Ultra Humanite was in a woman.
Sure.
But yeah.
As you do.
Of course. Who among us haven't had their brain in a woman, am I right?
Jesus.
Get your head out of the gutter. I meant the telepathy and shit. Come on.
Yep.
Come on.
Yep.
Fuck's wrong with you? This is fine. Yeah. This whole book is fine. I'm glad that it was enjoyable. I really like that Fialkov Bobo story. And that's kind of all I have to say about it, and that's fine.
Yeah, I think it is absolutely the type of book that I see on the shelf and I walk right past. But there is somebody who's looking for some like screwball goofy comedy like this, and they're going to love it. And it's well done. Like, I can admit it's well done. It's just not my thing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. All right, Vince, what comes out next week?
Oh, let's see. Alan Scott, The Green Lantern, number 5. Amazon's Attack, number 6. Batman, Dark Age, number 1. Ooh, baby.
Yeah.
Batman, The Brave and the Bold, number 11. Detective Comics, 1083. The Flash, number 7. Green Arrow, 10. Harley Quinn, number 38. The Penguin, number 8. Power Girl, number 7. And Primer, number 1. Is this another? It looks like they're releasing the graphic novel Primer as
yes. Correct.
Individual.
Yes, that is correct.
And that was good. I've read that. So.
Oh, I haven't read that yet. That's interesting. Okay. I'll check it out. Well, thanks for listening. Until next time, go to dc3cast.com for more, and we'll talk to you soon. My hot take is that Gavin Rossdale is the worst lyricist in the history of rock and roll.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
I live in a wheel where everyone steals, and when we rise, it's like strawberry fields.
Oh, you've never felt that way?